Good afternoon and welcome to this tele-news event sponsored by the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, IEER. You'll be hearing today from a total of four speakers. Before I introduce them as a group and then individually as they deliver their remarks, I'd like to invite the operator on the line to explain to you how it is that the Q&A period will work.
During the question and answer session, you may ask a question by pressing star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you would like to remove yourself from the queue, you may press star, then two. Again, it's star, then one to ask a question.
And we will have the operator back on the line at the start of the Q&A period so that you can hear once again how it is that you'll be able to pose your questions. I want to emphasize at this time that the Q&A period will be reserved for members of the news media, and also that you can find the information that will be discussed during today's news conference, including several FOIA-related documents. They're available to you on a link, behind the link on the homepage of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, IEER, and that's at IEER.org on the web. Again, IEER.org on the web, and we'll be repeating that information as we go along during the Q&A period. As I mentioned, you'll be hearing today from a total of four speakers. I'm going to go through them now as a group and then individually as they deliver their remarks. You'll be hearing, first of all, today from Dr. Arjun Makhijani, who is president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Our second speaker today will be Kevin Camps, who is a radioactive waste specialist with Beyond Nuclear. Our third speaker today will be Citizens Awareness Network Executive Director Deborah Katz. And, she's our fourth speaker. Actually, our third speaker today will be Diane Curran, who is a partner with the law firm of Harmon, Curran, Spielberg, and Eisenberg. So again, our first speaker today, Dr. Arjun Makhijani, President of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research.
Good afternoon, and welcome to this news event sponsored by the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, or IEER. As you heard, I am Arjun Makhijani, the president of IEER, which provides policymakers, journalists, and the public with understandable and accurate and technical information on energy and environmental issues. We aim to bring scientific excellence to public policy issues in order to promote the democratization of science and a safer, healthier environment. As the Obama administration's Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future convenes its first meeting in less than 24 hours, starting tomorrow, we would first like to thank and congratulate President Obama and Secretary Chu for canceling the Yucca Mountain project. I say that even though I support a sound, deep geological disposal program as the least damaging thing to do in the long term, with mounting piles of spent fuel at more than five dozen sites around the country. The accent of the program should be on the term sound. Yucca Mountain was known to be a poor repository site when it was named as the only site in 1987. Now, after $10 billion or more of ratepayer money has been wasted, it has rightly been abandoned. Along the way, the Department of Energy defaulted on its contracts to begin taking charge of spent fuel starting on January 31, 1998. Utilities have had to go to court to enforce their contractual rights. The liability cost to taxpayers now stands at $1.3 billion and is headed to more than $10 billion by 2020. It will grow after that if the DOE does not take charge of the waste. Yet, in its waning days, the Bush administration quietly signed more contracts with nuclear companies to dispose off waste from new reactors they plan to build. The DOE stated that it, quote, is obligated and willing to provide such disposal services, unquote, for nuclear waste. Significantly, it omitted to say that it would be able to do so. Evidently, it is not. Even the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has not expressed confidence that a repository will open within 10 years of the expiration of the license of the first new reactor. In fact, the NRC has not committed to any specific date for a repository in its new draft waste confidence rule. It has no logical or factual basis to come up with a date. It was rash for the Bush administration to sign contracts for new reactors while taxpayers are on the hook for billions due to default on existing waste contracts. These new contracts are likely to add billions more in damages at a time when the federal government is struggling with deficit containment, if these reactors are actually in operation, of course. Spent fuel from existing reactors and from the 21 proposed nuclear reactors covered by the last-minute agreements would fill the equivalent of two Yucca Mountain high-level waste repositories to the Yucca Mountain legal limit. Now, we know for the first time about the full extent of the last-minute Bush administration deals with the nuclear industry due to documents acquired under the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA. This is the first time that these documents are being released. You'll be hearing more about that and our FOIA request from Diane Curran. The challenge that faces the United States and the new commission in devising a disposal path for spent fuel from commercial nuclear reactors is enormous. Kevin Camps will be going into this in more detail shortly. Separately, you will be hearing also from one of our speakers, Deb Katz, about the more than 170 groups in all 50 states who are releasing today the principles for safeguarding nuclear waste, calling for specific steps to protect the public from immediate threats posed by the currently vulnerable storage of commercial spent fuel in nuclear reactor facilities. The principles call for safer on-site storage of spent fuel through the use of less densely packed reactor pools and hardened on-site storage, designed to withstand an attack by air, land, or water from a force at least equal in size and coordination to the 9/11 attacks. This is no academic exercise about safety or about amounts of penalties for federal contractual defaults on spent fuel. Neighbors of nuclear power plants face real risks in the post-9/11 time, and U.S. taxpayers have now been signed up for additional billions in likely nuclear waste penalties if the proposed 21 reactor projects proceed. I believe that it was imprudent for the DOE to sign these new contracts in view of its history of prior defaults and the impending likely cancellation of the Yucca Mountain project that had been announced as part of President Obama's agenda. These contracts started being signed on Election Day. It was not prudent also for the companies to sign them in view of the DOE's past contractual defaults and the trials and tribulations, literally, if I may say so, that they have had to go through to recover the added expenses occasioned by those defaults. That concludes my opening remarks, and I look forward to your questions.
That was the opening statement of our first speaker, Dr. Arjun Makajani, who is president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, IEER. The documents that Dr. Makajani referred to are now available to you on the web on the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research website. That's at IEER.org. There's a link on the homepage, and you can get to the documents directly from there. Now proceed to our second of four speakers, Beyond Nuclear Radioactive Waste Specialist Kevin Camps.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kevin Camps. As you heard, I am Radioactive Waste Specialist with Beyond Nuclear. I want to thank Arjun for having us participate in this IEER news event. I, too, share his concern that Americans simply do not appreciate the gargantuan task that this nation faces in dealing with the more than 100,000 metric tons of currently existing and expected highly radioactive nuclear fuel from atomic reactors. The bottom line here is that we have an industry and a White House proposing to race ahead with new reactors when we haven't figured out how to clean up the highly radioactive mess created by the first wave of reactors. Instead, 28 years after passage of the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, 35 years after the repository search began, 53 years into commercial nuclear power, and 68 years after Enrico Fermi first split the atom during the Manhattan Project, the United States still has no safe, sound, permanent storage plan for high-level radioactive waste. As Arjun explained, the FOIA documents we now have show in detail how the outgoing Bush administration took a bad radioactive waste disposal situation and somehow managed to find a way to make it even worse. As Arjun said, the recently canceled Yucca Mountain repository, even if it were open today, 35 years after the process to create it first started, Yucca would already be filled to its legal limit of 63,000 metric tons of commercial waste by this spring. Now, what did he mean when he said that a second Yucca Mountain also would be filled up under existing legal agreements, including the flurry of deals that were inked by the Bush administration in the few short weeks between Election Day 2008 and the Obama inauguration in 2009? Well, it would happen like this. A second repository, the same size, would be filled with the 42,000 additional metric tons of irradiated nuclear fuel yet to be produced by existing nuclear reactors, and the 21,000 metric tons that would be produced by the 21 proposed new reactors covered under the Bush industry agreements. Now, obviously, some of those 21 reactors may not be built and operated, but you've heard the calls for 100 new reactors. And the nuclear industry just last week went on record calling for 45 new reactors by the year 2030. So 21 new reactors would top off the second Yucca Mountain site, and another two dozen on top of that would fill more than a full 33% of a third Yucca Mountain-style repository, with a legal limit of 63,000 metric tons. I have been asked to run through the 21 reactor projects covered in those under-the-radar Bush administration agreements. According to the FOIA records, the sites are Duke Energy in South Carolina, Lee Units 1 and 2, Southern Nuclear in Georgia, Vogtle Units 3 and 4, NRG Energy, Toshiba, and CPS in Texas at South Texas Project Units 3 and 4, Unistar Nuclear in New York State at Nine Mile Point Unit 3, Unistar Nuclear in Maryland at Calvert Cliffs, Unit 3. Dominion Virginia Electric in Virginia at North Anna, Unit 3. Florida Power and Light in Florida at Turkey Point, Units 6 and 7. South Carolina Electric and Gas in South Carolina at Summer, Units 2 and 3. Pennsylvania Power and Light, also called PPL Generation, in Pennsylvania at Bell Bend. Progress Energy in North Carolina, Sharon Harris, Units 2 and 3, and Progress Energy in Florida at Levy, Units 1 and 2. Ameren UE, which stands for Union Electric, in Missouri at Callaway, Unit 2. And finally, Luminant in Texas at Comanche Peak, Units 3 and 4. You can find more information about the history of the deals involving those sites and the related FOIA documents on the web at www.ieer.org. We'll be repeating that information during the Q&A period. That concludes my opening statement, and I look forward to taking your questions.
That was the opening statement of Kevin Camps, who is a radioactive waste specialist with Beyond Nuclear. We're now going to proceed to our third of four speakers today. She is Diane Curran, who is a partner with the law firm of Harmon, Curran, Spielberg, and Eisenberg. Diane?
Good afternoon. My name is Diane Curran. I'd like to talk about the response to the Freedom of Information Act that we've reviewed. In that response, the Department of Energy has publicly released copies of contracts that the George W. Bush administration entered into with 21 applicants for new nuclear reactor licenses in late 2008 to dispose of spent reactor fuel when the new plants have finished operating. There was no apparent justification for the Bush administration's rush to sign these spent nuclear fuel disposal contracts, for which the NRC has barely commenced its licensing reviews. Having already paid out hundreds of millions of dollars in contract damages on spent fuel disposal agreements it could not fulfill, the government should have waited until it knew whether it could deliver on the contracts instead of signing up for more liability. The corporations who have signed these new contracts have already reaped tens of millions of dollars in taxpayer-funded contract damages and stand to get hundreds of millions more. The funds for the damages are coming from the taxpayer-funded Department of Treasury Judgment Fund. Here's what we found. In a period of less than 3 months, at the end of 2008 and the beginning of 2009, the Bush administration quietly signed contracts to accept spent fuel from 21 new commercial atomic reactors, even though, at that time, no repository for new sources of spent fuel existed or was planned. And the government signed these contracts even though it had already paid out $565 million in contract damages and faced an additional $790 million of contract damages at the very same time. Those damages that it paid out were for the DOE's failure to dispose of the existing inventory of spent reactor fuel in the United States. And $565 million is only part of what DOE owes on these broken spent fuel disposal contracts. The DOE is expected to face around an additional billions of dollars of damage payments to nuclear power utilities each and every year for the next decade. The huge contract damages paid by the government are for breach of spent fuel disposal contracts that DOE signed between 1983 and 1987 with over 100 operating commercial atomic reactors in the United States. Those contracts required DOE to begin accepting waste from utilities on January 31, 1998. Of course, DOE was not able to deliver on that commitment. And when the deadline was missed, the first of a current total of 71 lawsuits was filed by nuclear utilities against DOE for breach of contract, seeking damages to compensate them for on-site storage costs. As of July 2009, $565 million in damages had been awarded and paid to five nuclear utilities pursuant to settlements, and there was one trial court judgment that was not appealed. The funding for these damage awards is ultimately coming out of the U.S. Treasury because the courts have ruled that the ratepayer-funded Nuclear Waste Fund, which is estimated to have $23.8 billion remaining at the end of fiscal year 2009, cannot be used to pay liability to nuclear utility waste contract holders. The Department of Energy has estimated that by 2020, taxpayer liability for breach of these existing contracts will amount to $12.3 billion. That's around $1 billion of damages damage payments to nuclear power utilities each and every year for the next decade. The DOE has not yet estimated the government's liability for these existing contracts beyond 2020. But the nuclear industry itself estimates damages will top $50 billion of taxpayer money. Significantly, neither of these estimates reflects the impact of the 21 proposed reactor projects covered under the Bush administration agreements with major utilities that were signed in late 2008, early 2009. In closing, I want to underscore the fact that the new spent fuel disposal contract signed in the waning days of the Bush administration will add significantly to the government's future liability. In addition to damages, the Department of Justice has thus far expended another $154 million of taxpayer money trying to defend the Department of Energy against breach of contract charges and damage awards. This endless litigation at taxpayer expense is expected to continue indefinitely for decades to come. Thank you. I'll look forward to hearing your questions.
That was the opening statement of our third speaker, Diane Curran, who is a partner with the law firm of Harmon, Curran, Spielberg, and Eisenberg. And that takes us to our fourth and final speaker before the Q&A period begins. Her name is Deborah Katz. She is Executive Director of the Citizens Awareness Network.
Hi. My name is Deb Katz. I work with Citizens Awareness Network, which is a grassroots regional group throughout New England and the Northeast. We have about 3,000 members. And in a certain way, I guess I'm here as someone who is impacted by the issues of the nuclear fuel cycle and the problems in dealing with high-level waste. I live 4.5 miles. I live in Rowe, Massachusetts. 4.5 miles from the Yankee Row reactor, which is shuttered but is now basically an interim high-level nuclear waste dump with 40 million curies sitting on the banks of the Deerfield River with metal fence around it and some security guards. And 16 miles away from me to the east is the Vermont Yankee reactor, a Mark I reactor that has a fuel pool with over 50 million curies of high-level waste in it. The fuel pool is located outside of containment, seven stories in the air, with a metal roof on it. In a certain way, before 9/11, I didn't think much about the issues of high-level waste. I thought about nuclear power. But with 9/11, and I think people in New England and the Northeast have been impacted, know someone or know of someone who didn't survive what happened on 9/11, so that the issues of the vulnerability of fuel pools and their nuclear waste are real and immediate to us. In fact, the National Academy of Sciences did a report, I think it was in 2005, that acknowledged that fuel pools were vulnerable to terrorism and gave recommendations that neither the Nuclear Regulatory Commission nor the nuclear industry, in fact, have implemented in any thorough way. And so I'm here to represent these principles for safeguarding the nuclear waste, which involves, in fact, taking a lot of the waste that's in the fuel pools out and returning the pools to what's called an open frame, basically low density pool, so that if there is an attack on a pool, there isn't much in it to make it desirable to terrorists. We are also calling for the waste to be hardened on site, which would involve ensuring that the dry cask storage would be made in such a way, you know, where it may have layers of concrete and steel so that it also could not cause a significant release of radiation to the environment, potentially having the casks separated much further than they are, like at Roe, which I think is about 6 feet apart. We're also talking about asking for the pools to be reinforced so that they themselves are protected, and we're asking for funding for local and state governments to actually monitor the sites, which don't take place in any reasonable way at this point. And we're calling for prohibiting reprocessing, which we don't believe is a solution to any of these problems. I'm confounded by the Obama administration promoting nuclear power at the point when there are no scientifically sound or environmentally just solutions to this generation's waste. And the commitments that had been made by the nuclear industry to reactor communities that these problems would be solved by the time these reactors were put to bed has proved to be false and untenable. What we hope the Blue Ribbon Commission will do, and what they do in terms of their recommendations for the solution to these problems, which may take decades, if not, you know, 50, 100 years to implement, we are asking that they also implement recommendations for the interim storage of the waste, which at this point looks like it could go on for at least as long as I'm going to be alive. Thank you.
And that was the fourth and final speaker you're hearing from today before the Q&A period begins. Her name is Deborah Katz. She is Executive Director of the Citizens Awareness Network. We're now going to proceed to the Q&A period, and at this time we'll invite the operator back on the line to explain how the question and answer period will work. The Q&A period is reserved for members of the media, and we do want to encourage you to take this opportunity to interact with the experts that we've gathered for you today. Operator?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you decide to withdraw your question, please press star, then two. To remove yourself from the list, please limit yourself to one question and a single follow-up. If you need to ask an additional question, please know that you may press star then one to rejoin the queue.
Operator, let's proceed with our first question.
The first question comes from Keith Rogers of Las Vegas Review-Journal. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Keith Rogers, Las Vegas Review-Journal. I'd like to ask Arjun and Kevin, perhaps, if Yucca Mountain is not the solution for safe nuclear waste disposal, what is?
Oh, Keith. We are not naysayers at the Institute. We long ago published the right way to go about designing a geologic repository program. And at an appropriate time, I intend to convey my recommendations to the CHU Commission. Just in brief, I think rushing to find new sites is not the right way to do this. There are three elements to a repository, which is the geologic setting, the containers in which you're going to dispose this off. And remember, a repository is a mine that has to be filled back up, and you've got joints and new surfaces through which water could leak. So you've got these sealants. So all three elements have to work together. And I think we need to take a breather for about 10 years and invigorate a scientifically thorough program of understanding how these three combinations could work together in different geologic settings. And I think Secretary Chu is the right person to start such a thorough science program.
Well, do you think Yucca Mountain will come back on the table at some point, or is it totally not a suitable site in your opinion?
Well, Keith, you know, I think you know that I have said, supporting a repository program, that Yucca Mountain is the worst single site that has been investigated in the United States for a number of reasons. It doesn't meet any of the criteria for a sound geologic isolation system. It's got a small amount of water, a unique aquifer. It's an oxidizing environment that could corrode the containers. It's very difficult to characterize because of the complexity of its geology, so you can't be certain what's going to happen. So it doesn't meet any of the criteria. I think by any reasonable, we shouldn't be wasting more time on Yucca Mountain. That's my opinion.
Keith, this is Kevin Camps. Thanks for the question. I would just add that we should stop making radioactive waste. We do have the 63,000 metric tons already from commercial reactors, but we can prevent this problem in the future, and certainly the waste should not be generated at taxpayer subsidy or taxpayer financial risk. And these nuclear loan guarantees that are being proposed for new reactors represent a taxpayer subsidy, certainly taxpayer financial risk. And these new waste disposal contracts as well, if you read the Energy Secretary Bodman's statement at the time on October 31st, 2008, the Bush administration very much intended these new waste disposal contracts to provide yet another leg up for the new reactors. And ultimately, as we've said, that could represent billions of dollars in taxpayer liability in the future.
Is there a follow-up question? If not, we want to encourage anyone who poses a question initially who may have additional questions to feel free to go back into the queue. But at this time, operator, let's proceed to our second questioner.
The next question is from Elaine Hiruo of Plots. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Do any of you on the panel think then that there should be some kind of limit on the time for dry storage of this spent fuel?
Well, this is Arjun Makhijani. You know, dry storage hasn't been thought through in the manner it should have been. We've got dry casks, and it's better to have it in dry casks than in the pools, but we haven't figured out how we're going to get it out of the dry casks if they wear out and if the on-site storage is very long into new dry casks, how we're going to do interchange to transportation containers and disposal containers. This is a chess game, and it's being played like a horse race. And that's not that leaves a lot of gaps, and I hope that the Q Commission will actually address all the fine details of both on-site storage, as Deb has said, hardened storage, along with how it marries the necessities of a repository program.
Could you explain as a follow-up then just what exactly you mean by hardened storage, how that differs from dry cast?
Well, these dry casts are vulnerable, you know, to severe terrorist attacks. You could have fires once that dry cast containment is breached and dispersal of radioactivity, not as bad as from spent fuel pools, but significant dispersal of radioactivity. By hardened storage, you mean a couple of things. One is that the visual and infrared signatures of this waste, this hot, should not be viewable, seeable from off-site so that they're hard to attack. And secondly, the storage should be much more robust and perhaps spaced out so that if attacked, you don't get multiple containers that are damaged and containers that are catching fire. So there are some design criteria for hardening storage. You know, we harden storage and other things. You know, you store missiles in hardened facilities. And I think we need to store this waste in hardened facilities as well.
Elaine, this is Kevin Camps again at Beyond Nuclear. And I just wanted to emphasize another part of the principles on hardened on-site storage that point to the need for more quality assurance and quality control in the design and manufacture of the dry casks to begin with. Because even in a hardened on-site storage scenario, it will still be dry casks at the heart of the system. And we have abundant evidence from industry and Nuclear Regulatory Commission whistleblowers that there are major problems with the quality assurance and quality control of the current generation of dry casks. These include even leading dry cask models like Holtec from Holtec International, as well as some of the older models that are out there, like the ventilated storage casks deployed at several reactor sites, where we're seeing defective welding and other manufacturing and design defects.
Our next question, operator.
The next question comes from Wayne Barber of Power Daily. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I would like to ask the panel what they thought of resolution and letter that came out within the past several days from Jay Inslee of Washington, Democrat, and also Democratic Whip James Clyburn of South Carolina that criticized the Obama administration for dropping Yucca Mountain, saying that the Yucca Mountain science had been approved by Congress previously, and also citing the lawsuits that you all did earlier that the nuclear waste has got to go somewhere, and this without Yucca Mountain, that leaves us without an immediate option for storing the waste. I was wondering if any of you had seen the resolution and letter and what your thoughts were on that.
Shell, you want to take it, or do you want me to take it? Who wants to take that? I'm happy to take it.
Go ahead, Arjun. Yeah.
Well, I've read the resolution. I think ratepayers and congressional representatives who represent states and districts with nuclear utilities have a right to be aggrieved. $12 billion of ratepayers' money has been wasted. There has been an impression that somehow this is scientifically sound because President Bush said so and Congress said so. But remember that the procedure for declaring something scientifically sound has been backwards. This site was declared suitable by the President and DOE and Congress before there was even a license application. Now, in order technically to see that it is suitable, at least there has to be a license application, you have to go through it. Now, I have examined, you know, the technical details of the site, and like many others, I have concluded that it's not suitable. But I don't think that declaration was a scientific declaration. It might have been in the interest of the voting public in these districts, and I understand the spirit of the resolution in that people feel aggrieved. But I do think, and as somebody who has always supported a repository program for two decades, that and been on the record as supporting one as an environmentalist, that the idea that Yucca Mountain is somehow a sound site does not bear independent scientific scrutiny. So I think that part of this resolution is quite misplaced.
This is Deb Katz. I'd also like to speak to this in a different light, which is how confounding and difficult this issue is, because it is a very controversial issue. And here's this Blue Ribbon Commission meeting, and there are things that we're recommending they do. At the same time, there are legislators trying to bring back Yucca Mountain. And what it speaks to is how confounding and difficult it is to work on this issue and to actually find resolution which leaves nuclear reactor communities vulnerable. It leaves our country vulnerable, and it leads to a very confounding sense about why are we pushing forward with supporting nuclear power at a point where we can't even deal with the waste from the operating reactors.
And Wayne, this is Kevin Camps at Beyond Nuclear. I just wanted to add that there's tremendous danger in rushing these decisions, especially on the basis of raw politics instead of sound science. And that's the entire history of the Yucca Mountain Project. Because once you centralize this material in a single congressional district or even a small number of congressional districts, chances are that's where it's going to stay perhaps forever. And we've seen attempts to centralize, supposedly on an interim basis, this material at places like the Mescalero Apache Indian Reservation in New Mexico, the Skull Valley Goshutes Indian Reservation in Utah, and at Yucca Mountain itself, even before the scientific studies were done at Yucca, which have revealed so many geological flaws with the site. So we really need to stop the raw politics and the rush jobs that are involved in trying to answer this devilishly complicated question.
Thank you.
If there is no follow-up, we will proceed to the next question, operator.
The next question comes from Sunny Lewis of the Environment News Service. Please go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for holding this call. My question has to do with the creation of MOX fuel from spent fuel. And I entered the call late, so I don't know if you dealt with this in the original comments, but I'd like to know what you think of this method of handling spent fuel to make mixed plutonium-uranium oxide, which is then used again as a fuel.
Well, I think this is Arjun Makhijani. There are two separate questions in your question. One is MOX fuel from surplus military plutonium, defense plutonium, and the other is what the French do make MOX fuel from the reprocessing. No, we did not address this in this call because it's a little bit outside the scope of the call, but I can address it briefly. MOX fuel is expensive, much more expensive than uranium fuel. It creates new proliferation risks. Reprocessing, as done in France, doesn't really reuse much of the spent fuel. Overall, the French use only about 1% of the recovered material, recovered uranium, and plutonium. It doesn't really solve any problem because the MOX spent fuel is even more difficult to dispose of, and then you have polluted, depleted uranium from the re-enrichment. So it just complicates things. I think making MOX fuel is ill-advised either from defense material, and even more ill-advised as reprocessing from commercial fuel.
May I have a follow-up? I note that the French nuclear company Areva has lots of activity going on in the United States, and I would like to know if you think solutions like this that the French have developed are then going to be introduced and possibly pushed hard in the United States.
Well, you know, if it is on the technical, economic, proliferation, safety, and environmental merits, we would not be considering reprocessing. The French, I have studied the French system. You can find a 250-page report in French on the repository program over there on our website. And they discharge 100 million gallons of radioactive liquids into the English Channel every year from their reprocessing plant. They've polluted the oceans all the way to the Arctic. Their neighbor governments are asking them to stop reprocessing, and they haven't done it. They pay 2 cents a kilowatt hour more for every kilowatt hour they generate from MOX fuel compared to uranium fuel. And this calculation of mine agrees with an official French government report, which was done at the same time I was doing my work. That's also on our website. All of the French and English language documentation for what I'm saying is on our website. And it is largely derived from official French documentation. There's no secret about this. except it's not well understood in this country because maybe we don't speak enough foreign languages and we don't read the French literature. But I recommend that before we rush into the idea that the French have solved the problem, I think they've created a bigger waste problem because now they have transuranic wastes from reprocessing to dispose of. So, you know, and this is certainly something I intend to convey to the Chu Commission, but we should be handling our spent fuel along the lines envisioned, except we've really screwed up the repository program.
Our next question, operator.
Our next question comes from Doug Guarino of Inside EPA. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. I was just wondering if any of you had any thoughts or did think that any of the EPA standards for radiation protections need to be changed in light of the various things that is being discussed today?
Well, you know, right now there are two sets. There's one EPA standard that applies to high-level waste repositories in general that is being applied to the repository in New Mexico for transuranic waste. As you know, Congress asked the EPA to create a special standard for Yucca Mountain. I always have called it the double standard. And that standard is a pretty poor standard. It relaxes radiation protection norms greatly, and I'm quite glad it will never go into effect because Yucca Mountain is being canceled. A new standard-setting procedure will have to be created. And here I really would recommend the French regulatory approach. I have recommended it in other settings. I think their way of thinking through how you calculate radiation doses, to some extent their dose limits, are quite sensible and along the lines that were recommended by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences.
Doug, thanks for that question. This is Kevin Camps. I just wanted to point out one thing about the EPA Yucca Mountain standards, that under court order, the EPA did have to do away with a 10,000-year regulatory cutoff and instead has implemented a 1-million-year recognition of the hazards that would have been present at Yucca Mountain if radioactive waste had ever been buried there. And I just wanted to highlight, you know, that recognition by the EPA that high-level radioactive waste does carry with it a 1-million-year-long hazard, which, you know, if you divide by 25 years per generation, that's 40,000 human generations. So for a couple or few generations of electricity generation in this country, we are putting 40,000 future human generations at risk. And I think that there are...
I just want to add, Kevin reminds me, the earlier standard that's applied to WIP would not apply to a high-level waste repository because courts have said it should carry to the peak period. And the peak period would be hundreds of thousands or millions of years. So a new standard will have to be created.
And just to conclude, I think... you know, there's a very real sense that atomic reactors do generate a few generations of electricity, but their actual product is forever deadly radioactive waste.
Is there a follow-up question there?
I think I'm all set for now, though.
Okay. Let's move on to our next questioner, operator.
The next question comes from Janice Valverde of the BNA Daily Environment Report. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. This is a question, I guess, for Diane. Do you know if there is any way that the contracts that were signed in the waning days of the Bush administration could be invalidated, or if there is any effort to look into that possibility?
No, I don't. But I would, you know, I'm just guessing that... contracts signed by one administration that have to be enforceable by the next one, because how could you have any kind of long-term agreements? So I would think, you know, those contracts that have been enforced in the courts in recent years were signed, some of them, in the early 80s. So
well, I guess I was asking more about the fact that, you know, that they might be not legitimate given the circumstances under which they were signed, if anyone's exploring that.
Well, you know, at this point, I don't know of any group that is looking at that, but I had been assuming that, you know, these are, the government can make contracts with private individuals, and it's a problem here that they've got contracts that are enforceable, that have been taken to court and enforced, and I'm sure if anybody had an argument as to how to get out of them, it was made, and they couldn't, and they had to pay billions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars in damages. So I'm presuming this is just more of the same.
Could I just ask one follow-up to clarify?
Yeah.
The contracts that were the contracts that were signed for disposing of the waste that are listed under, that you've listed under the Freedom of Information Act documents?
We obtained them. We sent in a request and they
were
released to us.
I understand. Are any of these reactors already operational, or were these all planned for the future?
These are all future reactors. They're under review by the NRC. Most of them have designs that haven't been approved. They're way far from getting licenses.
And Janice, this is Kevin Camps with Beyond Nuclear. As Diane was saying, many of these reactors do not even have design certification from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for their proposed reactor design, let alone a construction and operating license from the NRC. So this was very early in the proceeding, and as you can see by the dates, you know, the first of the contracts were signed on November 4th, 2008, and the last were signed on January 22nd, 2009. These were very rushed in the final days of the George W. Bush administration. And one point I wanted to highlight, it's taken from Department of Justice testimony at a House Budget Committee hearing in July of 2009. The point was made that one of the key arguments that the Department of Justice has tried to put forth to defend the Department of Energy against these breach of contract allegations is the unavoidable delays clause in the old contracts, and so far that has not flown with the courts. But again, the Department of Justice speaker that day was hopeful that some courts would recognize the unavoidable delays, but that remains to be seen.
Operator, I believe we have one additional questioner in the queue. Is that correct?
Yes, there is.
Please proceed.
That question comes from Osha Davidson, of On Earth Magazine. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. This is for anyone on the panel, I guess. My question is about what's your understanding of the plans, if any, for the waste that would be generated by the two new nuclear plants that President Obama has announced for Georgia?
Well, you know, there are actually multiple problems with that. The waste would be stored on site in terms of the spent fuel in the storage pools and then presumably in dry casks when they run out of room in the storage pools. They also have a problem with low-level waste storage, class B and C. It's not the subject of this, but since you asked about those particular reactors, I happen to be familiar with that. They can store waste generated for a year or two on site, low-level waste. But there's no disposal facility for them to send that waste to, the Class B and C low-level waste to, so they've got an additional problem, and they intend to store a large amount of it at an outdoors facility, they say, whose design hasn't been specified. So this is quite a particular problem that these government loan guarantees are being given, even though the waste problems haven't been solved. And much as I like the Obama administration's decision to cancel the Yucca Mountain project, President Obama during his campaign had said that he would not support new reactors until the waste problems were resolved along with other problems. And they haven't been resolved, and yet he has supported loan guarantees for new reactors.
And if I can ask one more with that, people who are, including Secretary Chu, who are backing this nuclear renaissance, often use the argument that nuclear power must be a part of any solution to climate change. And I noticed I don't think that had been addressed in this, and maybe for good reason, but I wanted to get your response from anyone on the panel of what is your response to that argument of necessity that we have to find a way to do this. Otherwise we're just putting our heads in the sand and ignoring a far larger problem.
Well, I would agree that the CO2, this is Arjun Makhijani again, I would agree that the CO2 problem and the fossil fuel problem is probably the most serious environmental problem we have in the world. And I certainly have been seized of it. I go back, this is the 40th year of my involvement in energy work. I started in 1970. And a few years ago, I wrote a book investigating this very question. And it is available on our website. It's called Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. I met Secretary Chu a couple of months ago. I sent him a copy of this book. I would welcome any review from Secretary Chu, who's a great physicist and a Nobel Prize winner, or from his staff. I also gave it to Arun Majumdar, who is also from Berkeley, like me, where I got my doctorate, and asked him for comment. I think I have debated my book with the nuclear industry. No one has raised any serious objections, technical objections, to my conclusion that in the next 30 or 40 years, we can phase out fossil fuels and existing nuclear power plants, not to speak of new ones. We don't need new nuclear power plants. We don't need new coal-fired power plants. And recently, I have found some support in the chairman of President Obama's Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, who has said we may never need another nuclear or coal plant. President Obama is paying more attention to Secretary Chu, perhaps because of sentiment on the Hill, but I think he should be paying more attention to the chair of his Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
And OSHA, this is Kevin Camps with Beyond Nuclear. I just wanted to get back to your question about Vogtle. There's a tendency for the nuclear power industry and even the government agencies in this country to concentrate nuclear activities in certain locations, and that's certainly true of the Vogtle Nuclear Power Plant, which is right across the Savannah River from the Savannah River site, which is a nuclear weapons complex facility. And also located nearby is the Barnwell so-called low-level radioactive waste dump. And I just wanted to emphasize that in the principles for safeguarding nuclear waste at reactors, as Deb Katz addressed earlier, there's united opposition among the environmental movement in this country against reprocessing of radioactive waste, which is an activity that has taken place for military purposes at Savannah River site. And it's fair to say that Savannah River site is very high on the list of potential commercial waste reprocessing facilities in this country. So there's united opposition across the country to the idea that Savannah River site could serve as a reprocessing center. And people will continue to oppose that at every turn.
We are now at roughly the one-hour mark. We're coming up on it at this point. So what we'd like to do is make sure that you understand where you can get additional information after this news event is over. You can find the news release as well as an extensive background document summarizing the issues that have been discussed, as well as dozens of documents that were procured through the Freedom of Information Act process that you've heard described by going to the website for the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. That's at IEER.org. Again, IEER.org. You'll find a link near the top of the homepage that will take you back directly to a page that sets out all this information, including the news release for today's news event. You can also make arrangements after this news event is over to contact Elise Aaron Wolf at 703-276-3265. Again, that's Elise Aaron Wolf at 703-276-3265. Elise will be able to direct you to those documents, as well as to any of the experts after this news event is over. What we'd like to do at this time now, since we've gone through an extensive round of questions, is to allow each one of our experts to offer brief closing thoughts. And what we'll do is go through them in the reverse of the order that you first heard them deliver their opening statements. So we'll go first of all to the person who is our fourth speaker, Deborah Katz, who is Executive Director of Citizens Awareness Network.
I think there's a great opportunity at this moment to think about how we want to create our future and what kind of future we want to leave for our children. What's completely clear is the legacy the nuclear industry has left us is a colossal failure. And at this point, the notion that we should support the continued operation of a colossal failure is unacceptable. And the opportunity for the Blue Ribbon Commission to actually come up with a finding that will limit this failure for reactor communities and for the American public would be really helpful. Thank you.
Again, that was the closing thought today from one of our speakers. Citizens Awareness Network Executive Director Deborah Katz will now proceed to Diane Curran, who is a partner with Harmon, Curran, Spielberg, and Eisenberg, the law firm. Diane?
Thanks. I agree with Deb that this is a new opportunity for us. And what the contracts that we got through the FOIA request show is that business as usual hasn't been working from a number of standpoints, including the one that we're bleeding money out of the Treasury for these contracts that aren't really capable of being fulfilled. And it's time to go back to the drawing board and figure out an answer that really works and that just we're not paying out lots of money in contract damages for nothing, but that we get a good solution to a really significant environmental, public health, and safety problem.
Again, that was the closing thought from Diane Curran, a partner with the law firm of Harmon, Curran, Spielberg, and Eisenberg. Next, we hear final thoughts from Kevin Camps, a radioactive waste specialist with Beyond Nuclear.
This is Kevin Camps. We need to stop making high-level radioactive waste as a country. We already have 63,000 metric tons at this time in the United States, which is enough to have filled the Yucca Mountain repository to its legal limit. If currently operating reactors continue operating for decades to come and these 21 new reactors actually get built and operate, that will create enough additional radioactive waste to fill a second Yucca Mountain-sized repository to its legal limit. We need to stop making radioactive waste. We need to phase out nuclear power in an orderly manner and replace it with energy efficiency and with renewable sources of electricity, which are cleaner, safer, cheaper, and are the way of the future. The United States is being left in the dust in regards to energy efficiency and renewable energy at this point. Thank you.
That was Kevin Camps, radioactive waste specialist with Beyond Nuclear. We'll now proceed to our final closing thought. It comes from the person who is our first speaker and the sponsor of today's news event from the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, the president, Dr. Arjun Makajani.
Thank you, Scott. You know, it's not very often that good science and politics coincide, or at least not to my knowledge, and I think in the Yucca Mountain decision, they did coincide. And that's very important to keep in mind, and I hope the Chu Commission won't take steps to revive Yucca Mountain or spend a whole lot of time on it. I hope that Obama administration will actually investigate how these contracts were signed and what were the circumstances. Even if they can't be annulled, at least it would throw light on how public policy is done, including 2 days after President Obama was inaugurated. The other thing is I think President Obama had it right during his campaign about new nuclear power plants. No new plants would be supported till waste proliferation and safety issues were resolved, and they haven't been. I think it would be good if we had support for a real investigation in the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for a renewable energy economy along the lines that I've been advocating, and that's implied at least by its chairman's remarks, and that I hope we won't be signing any new contracts along these lines, and that the Chu Commission will recommend an interim policy that will make it safer for Deb Katz and all of her neighbors, people who live near nuclear power plants, in the interim. Thank you.
Again, that was the closing thought from Dr. Arjun Makajani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. You've been listening to a news conference sponsored by the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, IEER, on the web at www.ieer.org. That's where you'll find all the related materials for today's news event, as well, including the FOIA documents that you've heard discussed at some length. After this news event is over, again, you'll be able to contact Elise Aaron Wolf at 703-276-3265 to contact speakers and to get those documents. Again, that's Elise Aaron Wolf, 703-276-3265. You've been listening to a news conference sponsored by the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. On behalf of Dr. Arjun Makajani, the other speakers you heard from today, as well as everyone else associated with IEER, we'd like to thank you for joining us. That concludes the news event.